Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And this is now the month of October, and that means a couple of things. One, that's the month of Halloween. Halloween all month long. That also means it's Monster Professor month. And so I'm going to do an October takeover. Monster Professor episodes going back to one a week this month. So every Friday, be on the lookout for the next Monster Professor episode. And what a way to kick it off then with my guest today. I have the honor of speaking with Dr. Tom Shippey. Now, if you're already familiar with that name, that probably means you're a geek or a nerd like I am. And if you're not, one, I encourage you to just look him up. You'll be amazed. But I'm also going to give you a quick rundown of all those things that I can speak to for Dr. Tom Shippey. He has taught at 6 universities, including St. John's College, Oxford, St. Louis University, visiting professorship at Harvard and UTexas. He also at Leeds held the chair of the English language and medieval English literature. That's a famous chair position there at Leeds, by the way. He holds a BA and an MA and a PhD from University of Cambridge. He has published more than 100 articles, mostly in the fields of Old and Middle English and literature. He has a long-standing interest in the modern fantasy and science fiction realms. He is a regular reviewer for the Wall Street Journal on both medieval and modern topics. He writes for the Times Literary Supplement and London Review of Books, among other journals. His publications also include books on Old English, on science fiction, and especially on fantasy literature. In later years, he has taken a strong interest in medievalism, and that means the way the medieval ages are represented in modern literature, the way he takes it, and a particular focus on Jakob Grimm. He has given invited lectures and keynote speeches at conferences in at least 25 states and more than 10 European countries. He has appeared on shows, he's appeared in documentaries, and other films and great courses, lectures. In short, he's a rock star scholar. And I get the honor today of hearing his taxonomy for monsters. As far as I'm aware, he's never published or shared this anywhere else. And so as this circulates, here's the first publication of it. So if you want to know where Dr. Tom Shippey's taxonomy of monsters starts, here it is. It's a huge honor and a privilege and a pleasure to get to speak with Dr. Tom Shippey. First of all, thank you so much for deciding to talk with me on The Monster Professor about monsters, Dr. Tom Shippey.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Glad to do so. It's a subject of great interest, of course, and not only to me, but the more we think about it, the more likely it is that we'll get some answers to the questions, because it's a subject, as I say, which has created a great deal of creative interest. I feel all the time that I'm running along behind a lot of authors, all of whom have thought more about this than I have, and all of whom are coming up with different ideas. So I'm just sort of following the trail, but it is a trail which keeps branching. So all we can do, I think, is figure out what we can, and if possible, of course, it's always nice to have a new idea, and it's possible that people will think of some, you know, as we're talking. So I should just introduce myself a bit. My name's Tom Shippey. I've been retired for, looks like 11 years now. But before that, I taught at six universities. But I always had kind of two interests. One was the one that I got paid to teach, which was medieval literature. And the other was my own hobby, which is science fiction. And in between these two, you might say, there is a great deal of the realm of fantasy. Modern fantasy very often draws on medieval materials, and modern fantasy is very often written by people who've grown up with science fiction. So the two fields, neither of them very well populated academically, always seemed to me to be a natural fit, and I spent time doing both of them. Well, there's another thing, though, which is one of those curious accidents that come about sometimes. A few years after I retired, somebody contacted me from the Wall Street Journal and said, would I like to become their regular reviewer for fantasy and science fiction? And I said, yeah, sure, that sounds very interesting. And that's what I've been doing for the last, I think it's about 7 or 8 years now. Now, what this means is that I get to see an awful lot of stuff. The publishers send things to me. Sometimes they turn up in kind of, I have to say, avalanches. So I get a sense, I think, of the trends and the way things are developing. I don't see everything. And, of course, nobody in the world, I think, could read everything in this area. They tell me that there are 700 volumes of fantasy published in the USA every year.
Oh, my God. Is it that much? Wow.
Well, that's what they tell me. Wow. And I should think I probably see about 10% of that.
Yeah.
And I just have to hope that I don't miss any of the really the really groundbreaking ones. But this means that I do have this sense of how many possibilities there are and how many trails have been followed. And that's what made me think about producing a kind of taxonomy of monsters. Do I need to say anything about the word taxonomy, do you think, Josh?
No, I think they got it, or they can look it up and educate themselves. but I think we're good there. And I should mention, in case anybody's wondering, this is a huge honor and pleasure for me, because if it's possible to be a rock star scholar, Dr. Tom Shippey is a rock star scholar. while you'll give lectures on heroes and legends, for example, you are quite a hero and legend to me in your books and your articles, because you maintain not only the highest academic standards in your publications, but you remain widely accessible to even a casual reader, and that is a rare combination of gifts, I must say.
Well, thanks, Josh. It's true that I always try to be accessible, and I'll tell you why, actually. In my job as a professor of medieval literature, I was always having to look for trade, because, you know, it wasn't a natural thing for students to take an interest in. My successor as professor at the University of Leeds, he said, every time he went out to talk to the several hundred students who would be starting English studies every year, he looked at them and he thought, not one of these students has any interest in medieval literature, but all of them can be persuaded to take an interest in medieval literature. But basically, you got to go out and sell your product. Now, a lot of professors don't need to sell their product. You know, the students sort of turn up more or less automatically. But I always had to try and break through a certain crust of resistance. And so that's why I think being accessible is very important. And, of course, the other thing, which has become more and more obvious, is that if you don't sell your product to the general public, then the general public will not be sending their children to become students. If you don't have the students, then you don't have the jobs. And if you don't have the jobs, well, that's you finished. So getting through to people is very important. And it's strange that there are some areas, and monsters, I think, is one of them, where there is very widespread general interest, deep genuine interest, and it's not being serviced by the academic world, or not as much as it should be. Just to give you a few examples, one is King Arthur. You've only got to say King Arthur and everybody sort of prick their ears, prick up, and they listen to you. But academics don't like to talk about him because they don't believe in him. Okay, I don't believe in him either, but it is still a good idea to talk about him. Yeah. And another one, which of course has been on my mind recently, is Vikings. My last book was about Vikings. It was called Laughing Shall I Die? Yes, everybody's interested in them. They've got TV series about them and all that kind of thing. But the academic world tends to shy away from them because they're sort of, what shall I say, they're outside the comfort zone. And so you get people, whitewashing and airbrushing the topic. Well, so accessibility is indeed very important. And it's not just us telling them. We've also got to respond to people telling us. I always tell myself, you know, looking at a class full of students, okay, I know a lot more than they do about some things, but they know more than I do about something or other. Right. And I don't even know what it is. But quite often, you know, if you're accessible both ways, then you pick things up. And that's really what I'm saying about monsters. My sort of part-time job reading some percentage of the materials delivered in popular literature has made me aware of how productive it is, and of course very often what high quality it is. It's not just pulp fiction anymore. Okay, well, let me just say something about taxonomy. The image I have in my mind, and that goes back to being a professor of medieval literature, is a kind of tree diagram of languages. If you see a diagram of Indo-European languages, you see that they divide into separate groups. There are classical languages and Celtic languages and Germanic languages and so on. And then Germanic languages break down into North, West, and East Germanic. And West Germanic, for instance, breaks down into Low German and High German. And Low German breaks down into Dutch and Flemish and Frisian and English, actually. So, you have a series of branches going back to a single root. And with the monsters, that's what I've got one written out in front of me. And it's a series of splits, of bifurcations. And the first of them, actually, is artificial as opposed to natural. And the thing about this, actually, is that the category of artificial monsters is obviously a modern one. We didn't have them until quite recently. But they have actually started to, well, not just started, they've been going for some considerable time. So under artificial monsters, I'll go through a lot of these splits shortly, but I'll just say that under artificial monsters, you've got things like robots and androids and cyborgs and computers and artificial intelligences. And there's another category which I'll I'll hold back for a bit. And I could give you a kind of little history of each of those, I think. Robots goes back quite a long way into the 1920s, but they didn't really become a popular theme until Isaac Asimov started writing about them, in the 1950s. Yeah. And I could give you the history of Asimov, but I won't bother. There's his famous collection, I, Robot. Well, yes, but the idea, the image of robots then was really sort of metal men.
Yeah, and are you thinking for the 1920s origin, like the Prague play, Ronson's robots?
That's right. Okay. RUR, I think is the.
Oh yeah.
The common abbreviation. I think his name is Karel Čapek, but I'm never quite sure how to pronounce those names with strange accents. But anyway, Isaac Asimov, I, Robot, all that kind of thing. But of course, Asimov also picked up the idea of robots which looked human. That was really R. Daniel Olivor, the partner of Lige Bailey in the robot series. So we have androids, and that gives you Already you can see the plot of Blade Runner forming. If you've got robots which can't be distinguished from human beings, well, how do you figure out which is which, and are they dangerous? Ah, yes, but then also, what's the difference between an android and a cyborg? Well, a cyborg, I think, is, again, artificial. It may look human, but it also is capable of, it's got non-human parts in it. It's a mix of human and non-human. And at this point, we're kind of looking at Terminator, I think.
Yeah.
We have a different kind of plot there. And there are other things. Very early on, we got the idea of the dangerous computer. I'm not quite sure who started it first, but a familiar case is Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, where you have HAL, the computer, which decides that its main commitment is the success of its mission, and the human beings on the mission are the main likely cause of failure. So it starts deciding to eliminate the human beings, with the best will in the world, of course, but that's what it's doing. So we have all those possibilities on the sort of artificial side. Okay, well, let's put that to one side. I'm just saying that's the modern version of the monster.
I was curious if you think what you see as the connection to that kind of artificial monster branch and say the folktales of the Gollum, and specifically like the Gollum of Prague or any of that, like kind of the older mystic like creation of this thoughtless, you know, programmed type of machine. Does it seem like the part of that branch or connection to you? Or?
Actually, in a way, I think you've already put your finger on something, which is that the many of the most interesting monster types are kind of, I would call them interstitial. They are actually between our branches of the taxonomy. So, for instance, you know, later on I'm going to say, in the human area, you can have living monsters and you can have dead monsters. Dead monsters, well, ghosts are dead. Yeah, okay, zombies are dead. What about Frankenstein's monster? Is it dead or is it living? So it's kind of in between the two. And finding that kind of, finding a crack or a space between the different types, that seems to be a very productive way of proceeding. And I think the golem, as I call them, I'm not sure how to pronounce that word either, but the golem is also a kind of in between. It's artificial, it's man-made, but it's more magically animated than, shall we say, scientifically animated.
Right, it draws from powers from beyond just the designer, yeah.
Yes, that's right. It has its, what do they call it? It's a thing you put in the golem's head, which is its instructions.
Right.
But that's like a kind of magic charm. I think there's a word for that, but I've forgotten what it is. It's chem, something like that.
Yeah, it's chem. It's chem.
Chem.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's leave the artificial ones to one side.
Okay.
Then we have natural ones. Okay, and this is, of course, a much older category. And you could then divide them, and I wasn't quite sure how to phrase this, but we have animal and non-animal, shall we say. I felt like saying animal and intelligent, but actually some of the animals are intelligent as well. So under animal, I would say we got known types and we got unknown types. And known types, well, that's a very, very familiar group, actually, and not terribly interesting, to tell the truth. We have monsters like Jaws, or we have monsters like King Kong, and we have monsters like Godzilla. But these are all things that are actually real or close to real or expansions of the real. Whereas in the unknown set, we have things like basilisks or manticores or dragons, very often, you know, things which have been borrowed from early folktale.
Yeah.
But of course, I'm in trouble already because I made my distinction between animal and intelligent. And actually, it's well known that dragons are more intelligent than we are. So although they're animal, they're non-human, but they are not non-intelligent. So that's another case of something like a category split. But anyway, on the animal side, we've got the known type like jaws. We've got the unknown type like dragons. Fair enough. We understand the sort of opposition between them. And then we go on to the intelligent creatures. And here again, I would divide between human and non-human. And human, I'd divide between living and dead. Living, human, intelligent monsters. Well, actually, this isn't very interesting. It's kind of serial killers and what stuff like that. We don't need to bother with that really. They're not actually monstrous in the sense that we're using it today. On the dead, though, well, we've got several possibilities. We've got ghosts, we've got zombies, and we've got various subtypes, you might say, of the living dead, including wraiths, for instance. Meanwhile, going to the other side, we have the non-humans. And here, the big distinction, I think, is between, shall we say, native and alien. Alien, well, that's, again, quite an easy group. And actually, like the robots and the androids and so on, it's a modern one. I don't think that this idea really was around until people started to grasp the idea of astronomy. But then we get things like, well, obviously, one of the very earliest successes in this area was Martians. H.G. Wells, War of the World, Martians, Fighting Machines, Fire Rays, etc. That's a new kind of monster. And this has been developed, of course, to enormous extent by science fiction writers. I don't know if you have any particularly favorite monsters from your science fiction reading, but there's been a whole series, of course, started off by Larry Niven, about the Man-Kzinn Wars. Kzinn, you know, K-Z-I-N. Those are kind of a race of, shall we say, intelligent tigers, which are extremely aggressive, but also scientific and space traveling. Huh. And that particular set, I think, is now up to volume 15, multi-authored, all licensed, so to speak, by Larry Niven, and all set within the same universe. But there are others, and as I say, space aliens of one kind or another is an enormous group, and I'm not sure how I'd even go about starting to categorize them.
Yeah, that I was just going to say that alien branch. Yeah, I can't really think of any examples that came about since before, say, the 1800s. I can't really think of any that are specifically animal, but you know what we saw, I mean specifically alien, but what we saw with like H.P. Lovecraft was this odd thing of creating aliens but not aliens kind of thing, and so the strange mixture of like ancient dragon with modern alien, that might be one that crosses branches as well.
Yes, well, that's quite right, actually. Let's think a moment. Lovecraft, of course, some of his best stories, I think, were actually about hybrids. I mean, humans who had, in some way or other, mated with these quasi-divine creatures, you know, the old ones, and produced strange and terrible hybrids. I don't know if you remember a story, and I can't remember what the title of it was, but the main character in it is a very strange and repulsive human being who shambles about going into the shelves of Miskatonic University. But actually, right at the end of the story, we discover he had a twin brother. Only the twin brother, of course, took after the other side of the family.
That was Shadow over Innsmouth? Is that the one? Dunwich Horror.
Yes, that's right. I think it was the Dunwich Horror. The hybridization is a theme there. But actually, I'm not quite sure where I would put Lovecraft's old ones, like, of course, Cthulhu. You know, the whole thing is called the Cthulhu mythos. Well, what is Cthulhu? He's alien. There's no doubt about that.
But he's been here on Earth longer than we have. So.
Well, that's right. He's also sort of terrestrial. He's in between the two. And, of course, along with that, I was going to say that the contrast to alien in my sort of little schema is terrestrial non-humans. And, you know, you immediately think terrestrial non-humans. Well, we've got dwarves, we've got elves, we've got trolls, we've got orcs, we've got giants, we've got goblins, that sort of thing. Yes. But actually also quite common in modern fantasy is gods and demons. Now, I'm not quite sure where to put them. I think I'd have to have another category, kind of non-human, terrestrial, mortal, and perhaps terrestrial immortal, and put the gods and demons in that category. But that's the best way I can do it right at the moment. I might be able to think of a better way of categorizing them later. But yes, there's a whole string of possibilities there, of which Lovecraft is only one of them. For instance, you know, you probably know the Neil Gaiman story, Good Omens, which is inhabited by demons, mm-hmm. and you might know the Jim Butcher fantasy sequence called the Dresden Files. Harry Dresden is a wizard practicing in Chicago, and he keeps on running into all kinds of monsters, really. He runs into poltergeists, and he runs into werewolves, and he runs into vampires, but he also runs into deities. He finds himself caught up, you might say, in a kind of conflict on the deity level, in which there are characters who are pretty obviously the Norse gods, and there are also characters who are pretty obviously, I guess, Mayan or Aztecan gods. There's a kind of plane which is on a level with us, and a plane which is actually superior to us. Both these are open to exploitation. Well, I think that's kind of run me through my various possibilities, artificial and natural, animal and intelligent, known and unknown, human and non-human, living and dead, terrestrial and alien, terrestrial equal, terrestrial superior. That's the sort of kind of branching that I see in the field as a whole. But having said all that, and as we've already started to realize, some of the really interesting cases sort of go in between the genres. For instance, animal and human. Well, of course, nowadays we have registered the possibility of gene engineering. And so you can get what used to be called chimeras. Well, actually, they still are called chimeras. Yeah. But chimeras used to be something that was fantastic. And now we're beginning to think they're possible. And chimeras are kind of, I suppose, the best known example would be a centaur, something with the torso of a human being and the rest of him being a horse. So a kind of horse human. But there are many more. You can obviously imagine all kinds of chimeras. The possibilities are really pretty much endless. But that has started to show up in stories which take in the possibility of gene engineering. And I guess, again, we have a kind of area which is more like science fiction. And we also have areas which are more like fantasy. And in that area, I think the kind of animal stroke human split, well, obvious, isn't it? We've got werewolves, we've got vampires. What is a werewolf? Well, it's a man-wolf. What is a vampire? Not so easy to say, but let's say it's a kind of human bat. And those, of course, are again, borrowed from folktale, It's just that folktale and reality have been edging closer to each other over the last couple of decades. So that's one kind of case of hybridization. We already mentioned Lovecraft. Another one, which goes a long way back to where I started from, is there any kind of interface between the artificial monsters and the kind of human monsters? Well, we already said androids and cyborgs. Okay. But they're definitely artificial. Looking at it the other way, people have started imagining what are called augments. Augments are obviously augmented human beings. Human beings who have again been gene engineered, possibly by splicing in animal genes to their genetic sequences until they have superhuman powers. I can't think of a really familiar example of augments, in the science fiction world, but I have come across it now and then, and I think that's obviously a possible area of development. Can you think of anything, Josh, like that?
Well, yeah, the only thing that's coming to mind that would, I think, would be close enough to be strict in that category seems Japanese in my mind, like the Guyver kind of thing, in which, but I don't remember, that might have been Alien, actually. I might be confused about that now, but I had this memory that it was splicing these animal like powers into human beings genetically. Those who are better at calling up Japanese or manga stuff would be able to correct me on that. But I mean, overall, I think this taxonomy is absolutely brilliant, and I want a beautifully designed poster of it. And I'm kind of curious about a case. I've written a novel that essentially features witches in the modern world, as in every type of imaginable monster exists, but they're all the works of witches. So if, say, there's a werewolves, of course, are real because we know of them, but only because witches have cursed men into dogs, these kinds of things. But I'm trying to think on the taxonomy where witches might fall, if they fall at all, into the world of monsters.
I think looking at my little diagram, which I've got in front of me, which makes it easy, I think they go under natural, they go under intelligent, they go under human, and they go under living, don't they? So I haven't got much written down there, but I think we could certainly put in witches in that category, and then they kind of find themselves confronting the dead human category, the zombies and the ghosts. But surely we could put those in. And as I say, somewhere down the line, we have to put in gods and demons, which I haven't actually found a place for yet, but certainly they need to be put in. Actually, I'm kind of reading one now. Obviously, there's been a great deal of use made of Norse myth by fantasy writers, and of course, Norse myth gives you some very good examples of monsters, like the children of Loki, Fenris Wolf, Jormungandr, the world serpent, and of course the goddess Hel, who is another of the children hybridized between Loki, who is a god, and Angerbotha, who is a giantess. So, you know, we could actually, one of the good signs of this taxonomy is I can kind of find a place for them straight away. They can quite easily be fitted in. But one of the writers who has pursued this most repeatedly is a lady called Joanne Harris. And she wrote a book called The Gospel of Loki, which was sort of the Norse myths told from the viewpoint of Loki, because in the standard viewpoint, he gets the blame for everything. But in his viewpoint, of course, it's all someone else's fault. and he was provoked, et cetera, et cetera. So good idea. But it comes to an end at Ragnarok, and you would think, okay, that's it, that's the end, Ragnarok, that means everything's finished. But of course, it isn't. Ms. Harris picked up an idea from Norse poetry about how the gods' gaming boards would be found after Ragnarok. And so Loki, after Ragnarok, he finds himself in a computer game called Asgard, and then he finds himself actually in the body of a player of the game, Asgard, and some of the other gods follow him and turn up in the bodies of human beings. Odin follows him, Thor follows him, and others as well. Here we have, as it were, gods in the bodies of human beings. So once again, we've got a kind of hybridization. Whether they can count as monsters, I don't know.
It depends which they are, really.
Sorry?
That would seem to safely fall under any category you would include, like demons capable of possessing, because, I mean, they would be those who have the gods in them. I mean, that would be inspired, right? I mean, they would be possessed by gods or demons. And so, yeah, I think that would safely fit in the category where you would put your gods and demons, I think it would seem to me.
Though, of course, they themselves would say, we're not monsters at all. We're just kind of normal human beings. It's not our fault. We'd have to... Once again, we've got a kind of peripheral case there, which has been created by a sort of stepping outside the normal straight down the line boundaries. A whole lot of different possibilities there. Another one which crops up quite a bit, actually. And this, of course, is another medieval idea left over. Is it possible for human beings to inbreed, shall we say, with elves and fairies? Well, there are certainly legends to that effect, especially in Scandinavian folktale. And, of course, it's been picked up by other writers. And one of them, who I've been reading, is a guy called... what's his first name? I think it's Ben Aronovich. Aronovich is certainly the surname. I think his first name is Ben. But he, his hero is a kind of London policeman whose job it is to kind of keep an eye on the weird stuff, you might say, the strange things that turn up. That's quite common in modern fantasy, by the way, a kind of supernatural police operation. Yeah. But what he finds himself running into... and this is another category we haven't got into. There's a term, genius loci, the genius of a place, so as to speak, the embodiment of a place. And in Aronovich, the genii locorum, the various geniuses of different places, they are the rivers of London. Huh. So there's Mother Thames, but there's also Father Thames, but then they're all the rivers that flow into London. Most of them now, of course, built over, so people have forgotten all about them. But there's the Fleet, there's the Tyburn, there's the Beverley, there's the Chess, I think it is, or is it the Cress? But anyway, a whole string of these places, which he has picked up from old maps, and they are all... active and looking after their own interests in the London underworld. And of course it is an underworld because most of these streams and rivers, they've been built over.
That calls to mind some of that classical, the Grecian kind of pantheism in which every stream every river has its spirit that is essentially one with the river, although sentient at the same time. That's fascinating.
Yes, and of course, it's not just rivers, is it? It's also trees. Yeah. We have the idea of the dryad, the spirit that inhabits a tree, which comes up quite often, actually, not only in classical myth, but again in modern fantasy. And I'm sure there are other kinds of spirits located to a particular kind of place or habitation. But anyway, the question I asked was, can you in fact get hybrids between humans and shall we say, spirits of the place? And Aaronovitch at least entertains the possibility. This kind of thing, you know, he suggests can happen. In fact, of course, in his stories, it does happen. But that's another option of crossover between categories which we've actually separated out. So there are quite a lot of these. In fact, I think if we took more or less any pair of the various splits I've shown and tried to say, well, have we got an example of something that's in between the two? We could probably find examples of most of them. Picking categories and then saying, well, I'm not going to have either of those. I'm going to have something which is in between and partakes of the nature of both. That's really, you know, that's probably quite good advice for a prospective fantasy author. That's the way to start yourself thinking outside the box.
Yeah. And to throw one more out there to see your thoughts on it, I've just been stumped by one type of monster, and I'm curious if you could help me. And I think maybe your expertise with the Grimm fairy tales and Jakob Grimm's work might help, because I'm not quite as well read and studied on that as. And apparently I'm obsessed with it in my own work, and I didn't really realize until others have kind of psychoanalyzed me and pointed out, Josh, you've got issues with the doppelganger. And sure enough, apparently I do. And I guess many others have been obsessed with the doppelganger for purposefully or not, say Poe, for instance. And I've had requests to do an episode just on the doppelganger, and I can't figure it out. I don't really know what I'm stumped about, but I don't really know what to say about the doppelganger or whether it's its own thing or whether it would fit somewhere in your taxonomy. Can you help me with the doppelganger, Dr. Shippey?
Well, the example I think of straight away is, you know, the Ursula Le Guin Earthsea trilogy.
Oh, yeah.
The first of those. With the shadow. What was it called now?
Wizard of Earthsea.
The Wizard of Earthsea, that's right. Well, there Ged sort of generates his own shadow, doesn't he? And the story is not finished until they can join together again. But there's also, of course, the Harry Potter idea of, you know, the Horcruxes. Horcruxes are where you split off a part of your personality and then hide it. And, of course, that's very much a folktale idea, the giant who has no heart and who can't be killed because, you know, his heart is hidden away somewhere. But certainly the idea of separating off aspects of yourself, especially, of course, aspects which you are not comfortable with.
Yeah.
That, I think, seems to me to be part of the attraction of the doppelganger idea. The doppelganger does things that you would like to do, but you know you shouldn't. And I think, actually, this is going rather far afield, but Charles Dickens, you know, he rather often uses folktale themes in a kind of realistic or semi-realistic environment. And the one I always think of is in Great Expectations. It's clear that the hero, Pip, has a perfectly horrible life at the hands of his, I think it's his sister, who brings him up, and who treats him very, very badly. But the sister in the end is punished very brutally. But the character who does the punishing seems to me to be Pip. It's a kind of avatar of Pip.
Okay.
Because actually there's no other explanation for him. He doesn't seem to do anything else. Dickens, of course, was famous for not knowing what he was doing. He was almost a kind of automatic writer, you might say. And one of the things actually which shows up is that in most of his novels, the characters have the initial C and D. So you have David Copperfield.
Oh, yeah.
you have Dombey and Carker. I forget, but in The Tale of Two Cities, it's the same thing as well. And, of course, there's Clennam and Dorrit and Little Dorrit. Somebody pointed this out to Dickens near the end of his life, and he was absolutely horrified. He'd never noticed it. He couldn't explain it. But we can explain it.
Yeah.
These are kind of authorial splits. But that kind of doppelgängerdom, again, seems to me to be a really rather psychologically productive, shall we say.
Yeah, that's true. That's fascinating. And I'm curious. Well, you know what? My goodness, I feel like time has just sped right by, and I've kept you here for 40 minutes now.
Well, I was just looking at my watch as well. Yes, that's right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'll tell you what, I think maybe my other questions for you might have to wait for some other time that I get the chance to talk with you. But I think what you've laid out here is just an absolutely brilliant take on a way to make sense of monsters. Quite a bit different, you know, from my approach to it. And I think that's one of the great reasons I'm so excited to get to talk, with sharp readers and scholars like yourself on this. And so I make a call out there for anyone who's a great graphic designer to start making up some posters for us of Shippey's taxonomy.
As well.
Yes. Yeah. With plenty of pictures. Are there for listeners who are fascinated with finding out more about your work and your writing? We've mentioned the Wall Street Journal, in which they can find your fantastic articles on science fiction that's been coming out, but your books as well. Where would you say the best place would be to find out more about Tom Shippey and what he makes?
Well, I think actually St. Louis University, which is my last university, they kindly keep a web page open for me, which is sort of tedious because it's basically a long list of publications with some interspersed comment from me. And I think you would find that quite easily if you Googled Tom Shippey plus St. Louis, and I think that would pop up. I'd just like to say one thing, which is if you Google Tom Shippey, I'd like to point out that the guy who has just been locked up for insider trading is not me. it's almost certainly a cousin of mine, but I swear I had nothing to do with the insider trading at all. That is definitely not me. Until recently, I was the only name that popped up, but now this name has started popping up. And this, I have to say, I think it's at least a step up on the family records of crime, because up till now, we've mostly just been drunk and disorderly or assault and battery. So at least we're getting into the white collar stuff. That's an improvement, but perhaps not much of an improvement. Anyway, yeah, I'm the other one, basically. Tom Shippey plus St. Louis, and I think that should all pop up.
Well, thank you so much once again for your time, for your brilliant ideas, for your laying out your taxonomy, and for your patience and handling monsters that I wanted to throw into your taxonomy to see where they fit and whether they mess it up.
Well, I've written them all in, Joshua, while we were talking. So I'll do a second edition sometime soon.
Yeah, I've got pages of notes here already. I'm a faithful student still to this day. So, well, I appreciate it again. Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's a pleasure, Josh.
On the Monster Professor.
And I hope it goes well with the audience.